The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Rock, rock, rockin' Nicole. Rock, rock, rockin' Nicole. Rock, rock, rockin' Nicole. Once she grabs, she won't let go. Rock, rock, rockin' Nicole. Rock, rock, rockin' Nicole.
None of that soft stuff.
Rock, rock.
None of that heavy metal stuff.
Rock, rock, rock and Nicole.
Just a little bit of jazz.
Rock, rock, rock and Nicole.
Think.
Just I like love
that.
It.
That, all that right.
Great. Thank you.
A little theme music to get us going on a Monday. I'm Nicole Sandler. Welcome to the show. It's the start of yet another week. And this is the week that begins the primary season officially, because tomorrow is primary day in Ohio and Indiana. And, you know, most attention is focused on Ohio, and for good reason. Did you hear... You know, the former guy did one of his Nuremberg rallies over the weekend, yesterday, I guess, and he was he was in Nebraska, I believe. Let me make sure I have that right. I think it was in Nebraska to do a rally for a gubernatorial candidate, named Charles Herbster, who is accused of sexually assaulting 8 women. So right up Trump's alley, right? But of course, while he was there, he had to do the brag on about the others that he's endorsed, like, what's his name again?
You know, we've endorsed Dr. Oz. We've endorsed JP, right?
Who? JP?
J.D. Mandel, and he's doing
Oops.
Great.
J.D. Mandel, and he's doing great? No, you endorse J.D. Vance, not J.P., but J.D. Vance. That was the former Never Trumper who wrote that horrible book, Hillbilly Elegy, that I guess was made into an even worse movie. I don't know. I didn't read it or watch it. But Mandel is Josh Mandel. He's the guy you endorsed against. And that was said moments after... Allegedly, he bragged about his cognitive test that I really think he fucked up, because remember he said person, man, woman, camera, TV, right? Well, person, man, woman, or woman, man, whatever it was, I think he misremembered it and he keeps bragging about it. Why doesn't someone call him out on that crap? I know, it's a rhetorical question. I'm not really looking for an answer. But rather than watch his insanity, we did watch the White House Correspondents' Dinner on Saturday night. And I got to say, Joe Biden was in fine form. He actually had some funny, self-deprecating humor. Did I not pull? I guess I didn't. I didn't pull that clip. Here's a little bit of President Biden, in case you missed it.
I know there are questions about whether we should gather here tonight because of COVID. Well, we're here to show the country that we're getting through this pandemic. Plus, everyone had to prove they were fully vaccinated and boosted.
Yes, they did.
So if you're at home watching this and you're wondering how to do that, just contact your favorite Fox News reporter. They're all here, vaccinated and boosted.
And then the camera shot. It went over to the Fox table. So all those hypocrites, vaccinated, boosted, and tested, in case you were wondering. Trevor Noah was the roaster, the comedian of the night, and I got to say he did a great job. I was very, very impressed. He was sort of an equal opportunity offender. And my favorite part, oh, I pulled the wrong clip there, didn't I? He, of course, had to opine on the idiot here who is occupying the governor's office in Florida.
One of my favorites, Ron DeSantis, is here. Yeah, yeah. Oh, man, I'm actually surprised that he found the time.
You know, he's been so busy trying to outmaneuver Trump for 2024. I see you, Ron. I see
Apparently, Ron DeSantis was upset because he wasn't really there.
See you, Flair. Yeah, I've seen what you've been doing. Blaming Trump for the lockdowns, distancing yourself from the vaccines that Trump created with his own two hands. Nobody knew how to make vaccines until I made them. Beautiful, beautiful vaccines.
That's a good Trump.
How. Not even Fauci. But Ron is playing it coy, man. He won't even tell people if he got the booster.
No, yeah.
Or as they say in Florida, don't ask, don't tell. Am I right?
You're right.
I'll see you, Ron.
Yeah, all right.
You see, what I like about Ron DeSantis is like, if Trump was the original Terminator, DeSantis is like the T-1000. You know, you're smarter than him.
Yeah.
You're slicker than him. You can walk down ramps. Yeah. Because you see, no, Trump said he won the election, but everyone was just able to look at the numbers and see that he was wrong. That's why Ron DeSantis is one step ahead. First, you ban the math textbooks.
Right.
Then nobody knows how to count the votes. Boom.
Boom. There you go. See, there's an ulterior motive always. Ugh. Well, at least, you know, Trevor Noah is giving some publicity to the plight we face here in Florida. And a warning to the rest of the country. Watch out for that guy. I'm telling you, as bad as Trump is, he's worse, because you heard Trevor say it. He's more educated. He's actually a little smarter. He knows, he understands how government works, and that makes him more dangerous. All right. So with that, I just wanted to, in case you missed the White House Correspondents' Dinner, I wanted to fill you in on a little bit of the action. It was fun. Glad I wasn't there. And so it goes. Okay. Now for the main event. If you've listened to this program for any amount of time, you know that I am a Bernie Sanders supporter. In fact, see behind me on the wall there? I actually rushed to paint another Bernie, because I'm such a nerd, so that I would have Bernie in the background for when I interviewed Ari Rabinhoff today. Because I'm a nerd. So with that, I guess we should talk to Ari, right? All right, let's do it. Here we go. I'm excited about this interview because, well, you know, I'm a big Bernie Sanders fan.
And, I know. And I see you at rallies.
And you did. And that is Ari Rabinhoff, who was Bernie's deputy campaign manager in the last campaign and the author of a brand new book, The Fighting Soul, On the Road with Bernie Sanders. Congratulations on the book. I'm not done with it yet, but it's very difficult to put down.
Well, thank you. That's a really high praise coming from you. And a lot of people have said that they, especially Bernie supporters, expect it to be sad, but in a lot of ways was very cathartic.
I agree. And again, I'm about a third of the way through, I guess. I'm almost to the pictures. And I got to say, thank you for the pictures, because there's nothing like a great book, you know, when you've got a picture section in the middle. So you've got some lovely photographs in here.
Yeah. And, you know, during the campaign, there was a group of people who really seemed to love. I posted a bunch of photos on my Instagram with him, and people really seemed to love that, because it was just some things they never got to see. They're, most of the photos are still up on my Instagram at Ari Rabinhoff. If people, you got to scroll through some shark photos, but below them there are.
And on your website, you have a website, AriRabinhoff.com, and you have a whole section of photography. So
yes.
Is that what kept you sane on the road?
Yeah, you know, you got to have something that you're creating something out there. And, you know, it was a long 3 years on the road. And it, you know, capturing those moments with him, and the cover of the book especially was a meaningful picture, because I think it's a Bernie that people don't see. The standard for a Bernie book is, you know, him in front of a large crowd, fist in the air. And we thought about that, and we did a draft of the cover that, but we really thought that this cover of him sitting quietly and praying is something people don't see. And to be able to capture a moment like that, the person he's with is Jesse Jackson in that photo, but it's to capture that moment really, I thought, was a special moment. And it really captures, the point of the book is to show the Bernie that people don't see.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought this book cover was part of doing that, is let me show this Bernie. You see Bernie in front or taking a selfie or on a rope line or, you know, in national media. You don't see him in that moment.
Right. And so and that's something that you do share with us. You bring us into the private world of Bernie Sanders. Now, Ari, you've worked in the Senate. You've worked in media. You've worked in media critic offices, yes. Media Matters. Right. You've done the whole gamut. But you were not a Bernie Sanders pal or confidant when he enlisted you to join his campaign in 2016. Right.
Well, here's what actually happened. I talked to them numerous times in 2015 about possibly joining the campaign, and it never quite connected. Campaigns are busy. I'd never spoken to Bernie. I had had him on my show once. As you know, he can be a tough radio get.
Yes. And you hosted for years the morning show on SiriusXM's Progress channel.
Progress. Yes. And I had him on once. I wrote two profiles of him for the American Prospect, mm-hmm. when he took over the budget committee, about really what this meant, a whole new, like, we have somebody who isn't confined to this idea of debt and deficits,
right.
As a stopper on public policy, head of the budget committee. This is a new world. And one for the New York Observer during the 2016 campaign, where I talked about how, you know, the point of the article was people call him a socialist to say, oh, he's a socialist, that doesn't matter. But truly his ideology is something very American that you can take to, like, Teddy Roosevelt's 1912 Progressive Party.
Yes.
They actually did this fun graphic of Bernie as a moose for the article, because the party was the bull moose party.
Right.
So after 2016, I was at the Javits Center the night of the campaign. I was never like, look, I wanted Hillary to win the general election because I thought Donald Trump was a dangerous guy.
Mm-hmm.
But never really was like gung-ho, rah-rah Hillary. Had,
right.
You know, real problems dating back to the Iraq War. The election night happens. I was assigned by Sirius to the Javits Center.
God.
At about 9:30, I went on air and said, Hillary, Donald Trump's going to win.
Right.
And it was because of some stuff that went on in the Javits Center where I was just like, they think they're going to lose. Donald Trump's going to win. And kind of when I think we all had a bit of an emotional moment in the weeks that followed.
or longer, yes.
And I just remember I went on air the next day, Nicole, and I don't think people can appreciate how doing a daily radio show is both one of the most fun and easiest jobs and one of the most difficult jobs in the world. Mm-hmm. And the difficult part of it is you have to get on air, in my case, for 3 hours every day.
Yeah.
And you do the same thing. And you have to figure out something that's going to engage the audience for 3 hours every day.
Yeah.
And I just remember walking into the studio in Times Square, the SiriusXM. So I'd stayed at Javits Center like 1 a.m., didn't sleep out at all. Walked into the Javits Center, the Sirius studio right next to Times Square in the McGraw-Hill building at like 5:30 in the morning to go on air at 6. And I had no idea what I was going to say.
Right.
I had no guests because everybody had canceled.
Oh, God. Oh, that's the worst.
Well, everyone was just like, nobody
in
knew
shock.
What to say. Like,
right. What do you do? We all remember that night.
Like,
right?
They were all coming on to like cheerlead the new Hillary administration. And I was like, they weren't good. Like, look, and to be fair, I was supposed to go on a bunch of things that day. And I canceled everything because I don't remember that show.
Uh-huh.
I do know my bosses at Sirius told me it was one of my best shows.
Okay. I know how that is. I know after a show like that, that's highly charged and emotional, and where you're sort of on autopilot, something takes over and afterwards you don't remember what you said.
You don't. But I remember taking a lot of calls and having a lot of conversations and, you know, not knowing what to say almost. And we, doing the show, getting off air, having lunch with another host, not really knowing what to kind of do, and kind of thinking over the next few weeks, I need to do something to get kind of back directly involved in politics. I don't know if I'm the right person to do a radio show during the Trump years. I don't know if I can manifest the appropriate level of anger every day at Donald Trump to do it. And I, this isn't a critique. This is like, I envy the people who think they can, who could do that, because I didn't think I could do that in an appropriate manner that would be necessary to like sustain a show in that period. I wanted to get back involved. I had spoken to two people, Harry Reid and Faz Shakir, both of whom, Harry Reid was like, Ari, you've been Bernie Sanders since before I was dealing with Bernie Sanders. Like, when you worked for me in 05, you were Bernie Sanders. Like, why have you never worked for him? Why didn't you work for him in 2015?
Wow.
Like, what are you doing? Like, I know Bernie, I know you. You guys are a match. Like, what are you doing? And then Faz Shakir, who worked for Harry Reid, but also been working with Bernie for a while, introduced me to Bernie. We had like a 2-hour conversation in December. The next day he called me back in. I tell the story in the book. It was a very awkward thing. That's very funny that you should read in the book. I don't need to get too deep here. Save something for the book. It's a very funny story about him literally calling me into a meeting without any preparation. And then was kind of like, how do I trust you? You've worked for people who are frankly not my fans. And we had a whole conversation about that. And I basically told him he couldn't trust me and that I would have to earn his trust, and that a lot of people around him who we trust do trust me. But, and he decided to like take a flyer on me. And over the next few months, we really started becoming close. And I think he recognized I was someone who he could rely on, who, to be frank, every time he asked for something, he saw it was delivered. And he just, I think he saw value in that. And we just grew closer and closer. And I think part of it is we have similar backgrounds. Also part of it is, look, my grandfather was named Bernie and was from the Bronx. So it just one borough off.
Gotcha.
I knew how to communicate with Bernie because I'd spent my life communicating with Bernie.
Right. And you say at some point it got, while you're on the road, you two spent more time together than he did with Jane or you did with your family. Because that's the nature of the beast.
Yeah.
So,
I wanted to bring people into that. I felt there's real value, and he would say, oh, it's gossip, but I think there's real value in understanding who Bernie is, because most times you meet a celebrity, and he would also hate that I just kind of referenced him as a celebrity, but you meet somebody like that and they only disappoint.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not Bernie. He literally is what you think he is. And I think it's important for people to know that. I think it's important for people to understand that he's Bernie, warts and all. And, there's a lot of the time, well, couldn't you get Bernie to do this thing? And it's like, no, because Bernie's going to be Bernie. And that's the thing. I tell the story in the book. Have you reached the part about the fish fry yet?
No, I'm not up to the fish fry yet.
Okay, the fish fry is a good story about Bernie being Bernie. So we're at the Jim
The T-shirt. I did read that part.
Jim Clyburn's world famous fish fry. Mm-hmm. This is the best Bernie being Bernie story, where every candidate, it's the first time every candidate's together. Everyone has to put on the Jim Clyburn world famous fish fry T-shirt. I give it to him, kind of knowing what's going to happen, by the way. I kind of imply that in the book. You kind of know what's going to happen there.
Yep.
And he puts it on and then just takes it off. It's like, I'm not wearing this. You have to wear it. No, I don't. Not wear it. It makes me look like, he was literally like, it makes me look stupid. And, I say in the book, it's one of those moments where as a staffer, you're like putting your head down. You're like, can't my boss just be a normal,
of you is going, yeah, good for you, right? Because you shouldn't wear that stupid shirt.
That's the point. Like, half of me is going, can my boss be like Pete Buttigieg sometimes and just be able to read off a teleprompter? And then, but you're like, no, I work for him because he's not that.
Exactly.
And by the way, he is right. You have 20 people running to be the most powerful person on planet Earth, and they have to wear an ill-fitting T-shirt and look like a bunch of idiots?
Yeah, it's just demeaning. Wrong. Right, and especially given Jim Clyburn's role in what happened next, which I'm not up to. So I'm you're right where I am in the book. I think I just finished the whole T-shirt episode.
And look, I think every other candidate would kind of suck up in that way. And so, well, why can't Bernie just suck up? Well, he doesn't have the ability to. But by the way, that's why he's Bernie. Mm-hmm. The reason he's Bernie is because he will buck convention. The reason he's Bernie, I mean, you've been at the place in the book already where I talk about there were several people who initially were on the campaign who left, who wanted Bernie to say he was a Democrat.
Right.
And look, were they correct in that a certain percentage of Democratic voters who were inclined to agree with him would have, but didn't like the fact he didn't put on the team jersey?
A lot of people did. Yes.
Would that? Yes. But also, it, as I say in the book, it fundamentally misunderstands that then you just take away what is Bernie, right?
Right.
And Bernie would never say he's a Democrat unless he meant it. And he didn't mean it. He wasn't going to say it.
Exactly. And you know, even though I know a lot of people who have had the conversation with him, why not say you're an FDR Democrat or you're a social Democrat rather than say you're a Democratic socialist? Why use the word? I mean, I'm down here in South Florida where the word socialist, you may as well say, you know, a line from The Exorcist.
As you know, I'm not a great fan of the state of Florida.
I know. And I don't blame you, Bernie. I don't blame you.
It's you know, it's literally the worst amalgamation of voters you could possibly come up with for Bernie Sanders.
And there are, I mean, and he's got a dedicated following down here, as you know, he does. I mean, I saw you at the one rally in Miami, and here I am going, come to Florida. And I understand why you didn't more often. But yeah, that's another I understand why he feels the way he does. And he's got even more reason now because Florida's gone completely crazy.
I mean, it's just like, you know, it's an older voter base, which is not Bernie's mm-hmm. best voter base. You have the older Cubans who especially hate Bernie.
Yes.
You have, it's basically a mix of populations, like kind of wealthier. There's like the wealthier set of Democrats in Broward County who just aren't our vote. Like, it just, if you do an amalgamation of voter groups that like are not friendly.
You know what?
To Bernie.
The Broward County Democratic Party is the perfect example because I joined, you know, there was this whole group that grew out of Bernie's campaign, the Not Me Us groups, and they set up around the country and were trying to do, you know, takeovers, basically infiltrate the Democratic Party in each state. And we did it here in Florida. I became a precinct committee person thinking that we're going to get a progressive contingent. And we came close, but it's Florida and Broward County especially. And instead of taking on the Republicans in the state, the chair of the Florida Democrats went after the progressive caucus here in Broward County.
Of course they did.
You're right. So it's just a lost cause.
Because you don't have Ron DeSantis and Rick Scott. It's you don't have a state that elected the largest Medicare fraudster in history.
In history. Right. Yeah. That and they knowingly did it. So yeah, Florida. It's Florida. So yeah, I'm looking for a way out. But yeah. Bernie is this unique character. He does have a huge following here, but you also have the people who are so dug in. Well, he's not a Democrat. Or insist that he cost Hillary Clinton the race in 2016 against Trump, which couldn't be any further than the truth.
And he did more events, as I point out in the book, and mm-hmm. it's not in fact, it's been pointed out before, did more events for Hillary in the last week of her campaign than Hillary did.
Than she did, right. Oh, I know it. And you know, it's...
Like, what did you want him to do? Like, what didn't he do? He gave a beautiful speech at the convention about her. He did everything he could. Did he go raise money in the Hamptons for her? No, but
that's not what he
did. He never gone to raise money in the Hamptons for himself? No.
Right.
Like, that's not what he does. Like,
that's
what did
not
you?
What he does.
Oh, he should have dropped out earlier. Well,
no.
Did he drop out earlier? Did Hillary drop out earlier to endorse Obama?
No. No. In fact, let me share something with you because this was 8 years ago yesterday. Bernie Sanders came on my show. And it was May 1st, 2014. Let me get in the Wayback Machine with you and let me play this clip for you. Because it was when he was deciding whether or not to run the first time.
A couple of times you have been honest. You said that if no one else steps up, who is going to put out a progressive campaign, who's going to talk about progressive ideas and ideals and priorities, then I'll do it. Will you? I mean, what? Obviously, if Hillary's the only declared candidate, you'd step up and do it?
Well, you know, it is a... You quoted me accurately. That's what I have said. It's not that I wake up every morning thinking I have to be president of the United States. I think anyone who thinks that is a little bit crazy, given the problems facing this country. But I do believe that when a middle class is disappearing, when we have the whole challenge and crisis of climate change, when we are the only nation in the industrialized world that doesn't guarantee people health care through a national health care program, when, you know, as we've discussed, the gap between the very, very rich and everybody else is growing wider, when we don't have any campaign finance for home, when we have all of these issues out there, we need candidates to stand up for the middle class and working families of this country. I believe that very strongly.
Yes.
We can't have a campaign when the major issues are not being discussed. And I'll tell you, I get around the country a little bit, Nicole. I was in South Carolina and North Carolina and Minnesota last weekend. And there is, you would be surprised at how much support there is out there for a strong progressive agenda that represents the needs.
I'm not surprised. I know there is. I think we are kind of like the bubbling majority. We're here. We're just waiting to pop up, but we're here.
That's right. That is exactly right.
Yep.
So I think, you know, and the other thing that we need to do, and I hope people who are listening to the show understand that, if the turnout in this election in 2014 is low, the Republicans will control
everything.
The United States Senate and the United States House.
Yep.
If the turnout is high, they will not.
Mm-hmm.
Simple as all that.
It's not as simple as that anymore, though. It used to be a high turnout favor of the Democrats. And now, I don't know that that's the case.
I was talking to a data expert today. I just happened to be having coffee with somebody who's kind of an expert in electoral data. And they noted that we've reached this point of partisanship where both sides' turnouts are just rising. So that whole thing is now not true because turnout is just people in Team Blue and Team Red feel they have to wear the jersey every November, and it's a much harder climb for high turnout doesn't necessarily mean.
No, and it did just as recently as 8 years ago. That was just 8 years ago. And the thing is, Bernie's never wavered. You know what you're getting with Bernie Sanders, and it's the reason we love him. And you even make mention, you know, about the debates. We're talking about the beginning of this last election. And at the debate when Kamala Harris jumped all over, you know, Joe Biden. But then she did well. But then she wavered on Medicare for All. She, like, did a total 180.
You had all these people when Kamala dropped out who said, oh, she supported Bernie's Medicare for All, and that hurt her. Well, no.
She didn't.
Supported Bernie's Medicare for All. Let me point out, did it first. Bernie had never had a co-sponsor on his Medicare for All bill. Kamala jumped in 2017 before anybody else and co-sponsored.
Wow.
And was then first in line, literally in August, she announced at a town hall in California, and it wasn't a slip because we had heard from her staff it was likely coming.
Wow.
Because we were in the process of, like, we had this goal of getting 5 Democrats on the Medicare for All bill. We ended up with 16, which we were like, holy crap. But Kamala was on our target list. Her staff said she's going to announce tonight this town hall. We literally, like, live turned on the live stream and, like, we're very excited. But there was a strategy behind that I discuss in the book, and I think it's important, and you get to it, you'll get to it in a much later chapter.
Okay.
Where in this election, I truly believe inauthenticity was kryptonite to Democrats, which is why, frankly, the last two candidates remaining, Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden, were authentic people. Mm-hmm. Like, you can critique Joe Biden for a lot of things. Well, one of the things he gets critiqued for is actually being Joe Biden.
Right. He is what he is.
And kind of what he's going to say.
Exactly.
When he's going to say it. Not like Joe Biden never tried to fake, like, I'm for Medicare for all who might want it on Thursdays.
Right.
Come on, man. Joe Biden was like, I'm not for it. And we critiqued him for it. And we should be critiquing for him.
Mm-hmm.
But he doesn't try to BS around. He's like, no, I'm not for that. I just want to extend Obamacare a little bit. I'm not for marijuana. He didn't try to, like, fake it. He just said, I'm not for it.
Right.
He should be for it. And by the way, we should fight like hell to make him for it.
Exactly.
And he deserves extreme criticism for not for legalizing marijuana. But my only point is he doesn't try to fake who he doesn't. He doesn't. He kind of just is like Bernie. He is who he is. And I just believed in a world of Trump where Democratic voters saw this liar as president. Inauthenticity became really anathema to what Democratic voters wanted. And so part of the strategy, as you'll read about Medicare for All, was based on, and I talk about this in the book, this is going to sound real strange to you. You're about to like open your eyes real wide because you haven't gotten this part of the book yet.
Okay.
Spoiler alert. Came from something that Grover Norquist had said to me.
Okay. There's the eyes, yeah.
I once sat next to Grover Norquist, for those who don't know, is a right-wing anti-tax activist, kind of the most successful of that blend, who started a group called Americans for Tax Reform in the 80s and did a no new tax pledge that every Republican basically has to sign to get elected.
Right.
I was seated next to him at, of all places, the J Street dinner.
Okay.
Because his wife is Palestinian. So he actually
J Street, a progressive Jewish organization.
His wife, Grover's wife, is Palestinian. So I think he came to J Street for that reason. And on those issues, he actually has been fairly good. It's not a tax issue. He tends to be. Mm-hmm. He's not good on anything, but let's just say better.
Okay.
And there were two moments where Grover, the first was, it was one of these weird dinners in D.C. where you sit down at the table and they put the dessert in front of you before dinner.
Okay.
It's a weird thing some restaurants do in D.C.
Okay, I'll take your word for it.
Sits down at the table and just starts eating his dessert. And I'm like, Grover, I didn't really know him, but I said, why you're eating your dessert? And he said, yeah. He's like, if they put it in front of me and if the fire alarm goes off, I don't get dessert. It's like, we can agree on this. And I'm like, okay, you're right.
Let's go at it. Yeah.
Dessert first.
Again.
Like,
yeah.
Good. But like we have like a slightly friendly banter at that point. And he obviously knows he's walking into a room of people on the left at that dinner. Mm-hmm. And we start talking and I say, look, can you explain to me the kind of enforcement mechanisms behind the tax pledge? Because if any Republican violates the tax pledge, they know the world is coming down on them. How do you create, I think it would be valuable for the left to have some sort of enforcement mechanism like that. How do you create that enforcement mechanism? And he said, look, the beauty of it is you don't have to. Once you've signed in blood. And the activists, he's like, I get to raise money and the activists will just do all the work.
Okay.
Like, because they've signed and they know that if, like, once you violate this, I don't have to do anything. It's kind of self-enforcing. And I was like, oh, it's always something I've kept in my mind. With Medicare for All, once you've signed as a co-sponsor, there are enough Medicare for All activists out there that once you say you're on board, if you're going to back off at all, the Medicare for All activists will know it.
Right.
So we look at what happened to Kamala. Look, she supported Medicare for All. You got to praise that. I know, oh, she's phony. No, like, let's praise those who agree with us, right?
She did until the debate when... Right.
And then at that first debate, they had her, can everyone raise their hand if you don't believe private insurance companies should exist?
Right.
And basically, I'm paraphrasing the question. Yes. Only Kamala and Bernie raised their hand, right?
Right.
And then after the debate... They start walking. Oh, she didn't mean that. And then they come out with their own Medicare for All bill, which is pure BS.
Right.
And what happens is Medicare for All activists, of which there are a lot of in this country, go crazy and say, you can't do that. No.
That's even not people who aren't Medicare for All activists. Me, I saw that as a moment of real, just politics, disingenuous politics.
And it didn't mean she was taking the right position. It meant she was disingenuous. And most Democratic voters, by the way, like Medicare for All. So you're now anathema to them and you're trying to split the difference to settle these DC consultants and Medicare for All. And so what you see is rise, has that moment at the debate where she challenges Joe Biden on segregation, skyrockets.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then she starts walking back her positions on Medicare for All. She becomes up. And she's heading down. Medicare for All isn't what made her head down. She had Medicare for All a year before she went up.
Right.
What made her went down was voters saw that and then saw her kind of waver.
That's
she actually wavered in the attack on Joe Biden. She wavered in the attack. She wavered in her position on Medicare for All. She wavered in these things. And so when people started saying, oh, it's her Medicare for All position, that no, it was her backing away from all the votes.
Exactly. It was her wishy-washiness. It was her not holding true to what she said she believed in.
that caused her to decline. And what was amazing is there was no reason for her to be the first person to sign on to Medicare for All unless she actually believed it.
Right.
She literally could have been the third or fourth, or there would have been no. And why I say, oh, she was trying to run for president, but there was no bonus for being the first. Because nobody knows who's the first other than me telling you, Nicole, she was the first, because there's not an announcement that she was the first. It was there were 15 co-sponsors, 16 co-sponsors that first day.
Right.
They all get to be first.
Right.
But I'm telling you, she was the first person to tell our office she was co-sponsoring. That's the only public recognition of that. The only reason to do that is because you actually really want to.
Yeah.
Like Elizabeth Warren came weeks later. And we had real questions about whether she would sign on to the bill.
Mm-hmm.
And she did. But the point was, once you signed on, if you tried to back off, you couldn't back off it.
Those
who did paid a price.
So there were a couple of points that I haven't gotten to in the book that I'm sure you deal with, but I need to ask you about because you're here. Ari Rabinhoff, the book is The Fighting Soul on the Road with Bernie Sanders. So obviously I made it through the, you know, going to South Carolina to kiss the ring. Bernie doesn't wear the T-shirt. Good for him. Because what happened over the course of the next few days or weeks was very just.
Well, South Carolina was almost like 8 months later.
Oh, was? Okay. So it was after the fish fry. Okay. So, but all right. So let's talk about, there were two things. One is earlier in the book, you talk about Harry Reid. You worked for Harry Reid very famously in the Senate long before you went to work for Bernie. And, you know, I was surprised that Harry Reid was so supportive of you being such a progressive, and what you just told us a few minutes ago, how he said you should work with Bernie. When you said that he promised you that he wouldn't interfere in Vegas, I don't know. I'm not to the point where he did, but I do want to find out what happened in Vegas, because things sort of went sideways, didn't they?
No, that was in 2016. 2020, we won by 20 points.
Okay. So I'm confusing 2016 with 2020.
Then in 2020, we won by 20 points. And to be very clear, he didn't endorse until after Las Vegas. He waited.
Interesting.
When he endorsed the same time everybody else endorsed Joe Biden in that 2-day period, basically after South Carolina, is when he endorsed.
Everybody else did.
I mean, he had said he wouldn't step in. The question was, in 2016, he stepped into the race, interfered,
right?
Got the casinos to change some of how they did the primary, did some things to help Hillary. And he had said that he wouldn't do that in 2020. And frankly, he didn't. And there was one time that I think he could have, and really didn't. And it was the culinary workers were attacking Bernie for Medicare for All. And Harry Reid just stayed out of it and didn't. And the culinary workers announced they were going to have a press conference to announce their endorsement. And they announced they weren't endorsing anybody.
Wow. Okay. Right.
Which kind of shows he wasn't thumbing. If he had thumbed for somebody,
it would have been different.
You don't know, and nobody will ever acknowledge that publicly. But he kind of sat back and look, I think Harry Reid, if he had his druthers, I think he really liked Elizabeth Warren a lot. Bernie's just not his politics.
Mm-hmm.
They're interesting because first off, there is a ton of crossover staff between Harry Reid and Bernie.
That is interesting.
And a lot of that is based on a few things. It's based on, they come out of different ends of the, the product of it is different, but they both come into politics from a kind of class conscious angle. Harry Reid, if you ever speak to him, his childhood poverty, which was dreadful poverty, far worse than I think almost anybody I've heard in America has experienced, you know, grew up in this town that was barely a town in 45 miles into the desert in a house made of railroad ties, one two room house made of railroad ties. When his brother broke his leg, he screamed in the room for hours. Harry Reid would talk about why he was for, like, you know, he was, healthcare was like this, you know, he talks about when his mother, when he was in high school, his mother lost all her teeth. And he went to the dentist and he said, would you like give my mother new teeth? And the dentist said, no, not without money. And Reed went and worked at a hamburger shop every day after school so he could give the dentist money to buy his mom teeth. Wow. And he talks about how the proudest moment of his life, he told me this like the week he retired from the Senate, he was talking about it. So after all these accomplishments in his life, he said the proudest moment was when he bought his mom teeth. There was no moment in his life where he felt more pride. And so they come from kind of this class background, which now they come out of it differently. And where they come out differently is whereas Bernie is an outsider who plays the outside game, and that's all he knows how to play. Mm-hmm. Harry Reid is kind of the opposite side of that coin. He's just an insider who only knows how to play the inside game. And look, in the end, I think both are valuable assets in politics. Each of them kind of is very much, and look, it leads Harry Reid. It's why if you look, Reid throughout the course of his career moved more and more and more leftward on a lot of, on a lot of things. And also why, if you look at the number of people, you can list dozens of kind of people in the progressive movement, progressive staffers, not just people who work for Bernie, but people kind of widely recognized in the progressive movement as major progressive contributors who came from Harry Reid world. And it's because, I'll tell you something about Harry Reid. I was working for Harry Reid in 2005. And a few months into working for him, he supported the bankruptcy bill, which is one of the worst pieces of legislation ever. I went into his office and said some things that I think as a 40-year-old I could never say to my boss, but as a 25-year-old should not have been said. Like, just totally inappropriate. I thought I was fired. He called me that night. And the thing about Harry Reid, first off, just so you know, he never said goodbye. He just hung up with you when he was done with the call.
Okay.
A Harry Reid trait. So he gets on the phone and also no small talk. And he just goes, well, I guess I know you'll never lie to me. And then hangs up the phone.
Oh, my. Wow. Okay.
And on the Iraq war, because we talked about it, Reid knew Reid was one of the few people who by 2005 very much was like, this was a mistake. I made a mistake. Felt started aligning very much with many of the anti-war activists at the time. Really moved much further left than the caucus about getting out of Iraq. Had this problem where the caucus position was the Jack Reid bill on Iraq, which was a much more moderate bill. Right. And Harry Reid's position was the Russ Feingold. So he was way, which I mean, people now, I mean, that was years ago, Russ Feingold's in the Senate, but he was kind of before Bernie, Russ was kind of one of the left wing champions.
He was great, which it makes it all the more insulting that, what's his name is in there?
Ron Johnson.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Horrible.
So Russ Feingold, Reid was with Russ Feingold on the Iraq war back in 05, 06, 07. And it was a really, you know, he was kind of, and he always, and as kind of progressive activists in the Netroots rose, Reid kind of, you remember this way back then, kind of started allying himself with the Netroots, much to the chagrin of many people in DC.
Right.
He just liked that activist fire, and he liked, you asked how Reid liked people who disagreed with him. He wanted people to be honest with him. He wanted people who weren't yes men, and he wanted kind of outside opinions. So you got from there a lot of people in kind of left-wing politics ended up coming through Reid's office,
right?
Because it was actually a place that, even if the office didn't agree, kind of encouraged people on the left to be on the left. It was, and Reid cultivated that culture, which even if he didn't end up that way, he cultivated a culture that allowed people on the left to be that way.
Sure.
So yeah, when he promised, he said no interference. In 2020, there was no interference, and Bernie won the Nevada caucuses by 20 points.
Gotcha. Okay, so good. Thank you. I'm glad you clarified that for me. A lot of times these, between 2016 and 2020, morph together, and it's hard to keep them straight. What I do know is what happened in South Carolina. And Jim Clyburn for demanding everybody wear his T-shirt to then putting his finger so deftly on the scale. And just the whole thing, we sat here on the sidelines and went, what the? This was the most undemocratic thing that was going on in the Democratic Party. And I can only imagine what it felt like to you guys.
Well, we kind of expected the Clyburn thing to happen. First off, Clyburn had said he didn't think a socialist could win, which was clearly only directed at one candidate.
Of course.
There was always this weird thing during February. If only Bernie had met with Jim Clyburn, it would. No, Bernie met with Jim Clyburn actually numerous times. But those meetings were about community health centers, not about the endorsement. I was like, yeah, they met on the thing they agree on. And Bernie and Jim Clyburn, frankly, have been really one of Bernie's key issues as a member of the Senate. One of the things he's been most successful at is funding community health centers, which are a crucial link for a lot of people in this country. Jim Clyburn was never going to endorse Bernie. And, the story in the book, not to spoiler alert it, there were a few moments in that week where we had been pushing, and it looked like, and by the way, this thing I'm going to say next has been reported by others, so I'm not the first to report this. Mm-hmm. But there was the moment that week where Sharpton had told us he was going to endorse.
Okay.
And we were thinking we could get Sharpton and Jackson to endorse
together, right?
Together, which would have kind of balanced out the at least media story on the issue.
Yeah.
Because look, Joe Biden was always going to be strong in South Carolina. The question was how strong. But the point is, pictures, mistakes, and attacks are the things that journalists cover. So you give them as many good pictures as you can. You make as few mistakes as you can, and you attack. And we made the point, you have to attack Joe Biden. And Jeff Weaver and Bernie worked on an opening statement that cut into Joe Biden. Not personally, very issue-based, but was really cutting. And basically, like, you have the most experience on stage and you have experience at being wrong. You were wrong about the Iraq war. You were wrong about trade. You were wrong about bankruptcy bill. You were wrong. Just set the tone. And we did it. Bernie wrote it out. Bernie got a draft he was comfortable with. Bernie read the draft. Bernie practiced the draft. We walked into the green room that night. We sat down. Just prepare. Do it one more time before you do it on stage.
Right.
He did it. You could tell something was off, and I kind of tell the story of what happened inside the green room. People can read it in the book. And he walked out on stage, and I looked at Faz and was like, he's not going to do it, is he? Faz was like, I don't know. Like, and we were both like, and he went out and gave kind of like the Bernifesto, right? That we all love, like Medicare for all, college for all. We all love it, but it's not going to set the agenda.
Right, it's nothing new. It's what, right.
And it's also not going to, but you know, he saw everyone get on stage and I'd be like, oh, I love you all. And aren't you all wonderful? And it's like, that's the point. Getting out on stage with a knife and jabbing it in the guy next door is what's going to get attention then. And he didn't want to attack Joe Biden, right? Political reporters love to go put people on a continuous spectrum of conservative to progressive and like, where do they fall?
Right.
And the truth is people are much more complicated. There are Bernie, like the most common Bernie voter was not an Elizabeth Warren Bernie voter. The Bernie swing voter in the primary was a Bernie Biden voter.
Right. And I read that and that surprised me. But you talk about the beer track and the wine track and that Bernie and Biden are beer and Warren, Buttigieg and the rest of them are, you know, more wine.
But the problem is Biden has access to the wine track and Bernie doesn't, which is why going up against him, every other candidate, we just win the beer track. They win the wine track. We actually win. Biden, there are the beer track people who like Biden. And then the wine track people, if they don't really have a wine track candidate, will be like, if they're going to choose, they're going to choose Biden. So it's just an easier pie for him to grab. And what I mean by that is Bernie and Biden voters were less wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
Lower levels of formal education more people of color, especially for Bernie Latinos, but young African-American people are like, well, what about African-Americans? Young African-Americans support Bernie.
Right. Young do. Yes.
Young. And it's a young old division.
I see that.
Also among Latinos, older Latinos tended not to support Bernie. Younger Latinos tended to support Bernie. And, you know, Elizabeth Warren, Pete Buttigieg voters, Amy Klobuchar voters, older, higher income, higher education. That's who they were. It was, and we termed it beer track, wine track. What do you have to drink when you go home at night? If you're having a beer, you're voting for Bernie or Biden. If you're having a glass of wine, you're probably voting for Pete Buttigieg. And look, that's somewhat
overgeneralization.
Overgeneralization, but it was a good way of shorthanding it.
I hear you. Then again, I can't drink beer, and I do like wine. So it doesn't hold true to everyone.
And it was a good shorthand. For what it meant.
And I see it. I get it. So Ari Ravenhoft, here we are. We're looking at 2024, and the possibilities are frightening. There's been some rumbling that Bernie might run again. Do you think he would ever run again? And should he run again?
So first off, I was just doing another interview on another show, and they were like, so are you ready for 2024? On a personal level, I can't do it again, Nicole. Bernie outran me, right? He outruns everybody. His level of energy is something, I'm half his age and I marvel at it. Every day. He was out, the last week he was out in Staten Island with Amazon workers. Yep. Then he's in Richmond on the same day with Starbucks workers. Then I see 2 days later, he's protesting in front of the White House for student debt relief. The guy doesn't have quit in him, right? He doesn't have a stop button. He doesn't have the ability to slow down. I think slowing down is probably his kryptonite. Right. I think that would. So does he have the energy, the drive and the ability? Yeah, I just don't doubt him. When I wrote the book, I wrote it as if 2020 was his last campaign, right? Because it's kind of the rational thing. But, the office, Bernie's PAC sent out a memo, or campaign committee sent out a memo that got leaked to the press that said he might, if Joe Biden doesn't run in 2024, he could see himself stepping in. And could he? Absolutely. I just have no doubt of his energy. Could I? Absolutely not. I will support his campaign. Yep. I will donate to his campaign. I will help in any way I'm physically able. But could I? Could I ever do what I did in 2020? No, I don't have it in me to do that again, because the pace he runs at is just superhuman.
I hear you. And I'm one who I'm constantly sounding the alarm that the Democratic Party is the face of the Democratic Party is ancient. You got the average age in the House, I don't even know. But leadership is Nancy Pelosi, Jim Clyburn, and Steny Hoyer. What is their average age? Yeah. And the thing is, it might be younger than Bernie, but he's younger than all of them in terms of attitude and energy and ideas and the way he works. And it's not a physical age thing. It's a mental thing for me.
I would support Bernie if he runs. I also do think the Democratic Party in general, and this isn't a comment about Bernie, this is what you just said, because Chuck Schumer's in his 70s, yes. Nancy Pelosi's in her 80s, right?
Yes.
Jim Clyburn's in his 80s, Steny yes. Hoyer's in his late 70s.
Yes.
And the three in the House, Schumer's been in Democratic leadership since 2005. He's been leader only 4 years, but it was Reid, then Schumer. Nancy Pelosi's been Democratic leader since 2005.
Yep.
Steny Hoyer's been majority leader since 2005 or second. Jim Clyburn's been third since 2005.
Time.
We actually do need, there needs to be a new breath of leadership, yes. It needs to be younger leadership. And by the way, it needs to be progressive leadership,
yes.
Because let me tell you, their answer, the problem is the answer I hear from centrist DC is Hakeem Jeffries.
Oh, please no.
And that's not going to be good for progressives. And
no.
So I don't just want somebody who's young. I want somebody who has the values that I believe in. And Hakeem Jeffries ain't it.
Yeah.
We'll see what happens. But yeah, no, the Democratic Party itself, and look, our future, we need the next generation to start to rise, and it needs to be progressive.
Yes. And look, the future is in their hands. Our generation and the generation before us screwed it up. We didn't fix it. Let them take it. You got the Sunshine Movement kids. You got the March for Life kids. You got these kids who are showing that they've got the energy. They've got the involvement. They've got the
Can I do a little endorsement since you're in Florida?
Please.
Maxwell Frost, who's running for Congress down there.
Yeah.
Great, great kid. Great guy. young candidate for Congress in Val Demings' old district.
She's running for in Orlando area.
He is wonderful. He did some work on the Bernie campaign, actually. He is comes out of March for Our Lives. Wonderful candidate, wonderful progressive, hard worker, amazing, would be an amazing member of Congress.
Great. So I will have to check him out. Yes.
A Florida candidate who is absolutely wonderful.
And we need help down here in Florida.
And is, by the way, in the fundraising leading that race, is a
really
very good candidate.
Good to know. I will look into him. I will check him out. I got to ask you this. What are your thoughts when you see this picture that I'm about to put up on the screen?
Oh, that was a day. You know, first of all, I think in the book, and I'll let people read it for the emotion, I do talk about January 6th and Bernie and I walking through the Capitol at 11 p.m. Ooh. On January 6th and seeing all the broken glass and seeing what had happened. And I ended up on the House side in a tunnel. It's a kind of weirdly dramatic story. I ended up in Pramila Jayapal's office ultimately, just by chance. But I ended up being alone with Bernie for most of that evening after the incident, and I talk about that. But January 6th comes, so the inauguration comes along. And I remember walking into the office, and it was like crazy to get into the office, and it required like 10 badges of security on the car and all this stuff after January 6th. And Bernie has a staffer named Terrell who was getting him to the process, which was a whole process for him. He had to have a COVID test. Like, you had to do all sorts of things to get to the place where you sit.
Right.
And I look up on the TV in the office and I see Bernie in the jacket with the mittens. And Terrell walks in. And I was like, was he wearing those mittens when you last saw him? He's like, what mittens? And he looks up the screen. He's like, oh. I was like, yeah, that's going to be a thing.
It's a thing.
I didn't realize what a big thing it was going to be. And like my phone starts lighting up with everyone wanting to know what the envelope he was carrying was.
Okay.
Which turned out to be his tickets, because everyone else put the tickets away. He's carrying the envelope out there. He did have good laughs about the meme thing. And he was especially proud about the ability to raise so much money from it.
Wow. Nice. Well, this is a painting that I did of Bernie, because I started painting during the pandemic. That's a painting.
So he raised, just to be clear, raising money for charity, because all the money he raised from selling merchandise went to Vermont Meals on Wheels and a bunch of other local Vermont charities. And he was especially proud of being able to do that during the pandemic, millions of dollars to those organizations that were helping people in his state.
You know, he's a special man. He's, you know, I joked with him one time when somebody called me Sanders, and I'm like, well, it's Sandler, but I'd be happy to give up the L and take another S and make you my honorary uncle, because he touches something in us. You, in the book, you talk about the Bernie that we don't all see, but it's Bernie. It's that irascible, sort of crotchety guy who doesn't have time for the small talk and the nonsense. He wants to eat at the diner or wherever. He doesn't, he's just Bernie. And maybe those of us who grew up with a Jewish grandfather know Bernie, but he's Bernie. And I think that's one of the endearing things about him. He is genuine. He is honest. You know, when he talks, that's what he feels. And you don't have to worry about the politics of it. You know, it's Bernie.
Yeah.
And
that's what he is.
And I think we'd be so much better off if he were, president. But here we are. Thank you for writing this book. Like I said, I'm about a third of the way through it. And I'm enjoying every minute of it. And every page I get is like, oh, so that's what happened. So it's a fascinating look behind the scenes. What are you doing now? What are you going to do next?
I had this book. I've been, frankly, doing things outside of politics to figure out what I want to do. I've been doing a bunch of photography and some other stuff. And, I'm sure I will go back in. But after Bernie, I needed to, sit for a second.
Uh-huh. I hear you. Well, I don't think certainly it isn't. The chapter, the Bernie Sanders book, your book is done, but his is not. I think we have not seen the last of Bernie Sanders.
No, I definitely do not think we've seen the last of Bernie Sanders. That is certainly true.
All right. Ari Raibenhof, thank you so much. It's great talking to you. I'm loving the book. I can't wait to finish it. Not enough hours in the day.
Please, everybody, pick up the book wherever you can get books. If you don't want to buy it from a river in South America, you can buy it from plenty of other.
There's bookshop.org, which is a great alternative. I always, when I link titles in, you know, the blog on my website, I always link to bookshop.org, not the other one.
Or pop by your local bookstore, support your local bookseller who's like a place in the community who is hurting. So stop by there.
Definitely. All right. Great talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Nicole.
All right. Pleasure. You take care. There you go. Ari. Oh, my Bernie just fell off my microphone. See, still got Bernie here by my side. Ari Raibenhof. Good to hear from him again. Good to talk to him again. And all right. I'm in one more time. We'll see what happens. All right. Tomorrow, Tuesday, Gotta Laugh will be here. So we got that going for us. And it's also Election Day, primary day in Ohio and Indiana. So get out there and vote. All right. I'll leave you with the news and see you back here tomorrow. Thanks for listening, everyone. Have a great night. Bye.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Primary season is here, and all eyes are on Ohio, especially on the Republican primary in the race to replace retiring Senator Rob Portman. On Sunday, while holding a rally in Nebraska in support of Charles Herbster, a Republican gubernatorial candidate accused of sexually assaulting 8 women, the former guy demanded that Joe Biden take a cognitive test, and then he bragged about how he aced his. And then he couldn't remember the name of the guy he endorsed.
You know, we've endorsed Dr. Oz. We've endorsed JP, right? J.D. Mandel, and he's doing great.
Well, the dotard actually endorsed J.D. Vance, not J.P., J.D. Vance. You know, the hillbilly elegy author, former Never Trumper. Mandel is the last name of the other MAGA candidate. You know, the one supported by Ted Cruz and other similarly delusional Republicans. There is one top-tier candidate who has acknowledged the reality of the 2020 election, State Senator Matt Dolan, who appears to be benefiting from a last-minute surge. I guess we'll find out tomorrow. In the meantime, on the Democratic side, the top 3 candidates are Morgan Harper, Tracy Johnson, and Tim Ryan. Harper is the progressive in the race, Tim Ryan the more centrist congressman, and of course, there's the other primary to watch for the House seat between progressive Nina Turner and incumbent Chantel Brown. Over the weekend, Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi and about a half dozen U.S. lawmakers made an unannounced visit to Kyiv, Ukraine, where they met for 3 hours with President Volodymyr Zelensky. And this week, Pelosi, back at home, will try to steer President Biden's $33 billion aid package for Ukraine through Congress. And now we learn that the First Lady, Jill Biden, is slated to visit Romania and Slovakia from May 5th through the 9th, where she'll meet with educators, service members, and displaced Ukrainians. As for President Biden, he'll visit a Lockheed Martin facility in Alabama on Tuesday that manufactures those Javelin anti-tank missiles. You know, that's what President Zelensky was asking the former guy for when he attempted to extort him in that very far from perfect phone call. Remember, we learned that Zelensky asked Trump for an increase in military aid specifically to purchase more Javelin anti-tank missiles. And Trump responded by saying, quote, "I would like you to do us a favor, though." The Javelin is still the weapon most in demand by the Ukrainian military. Ukraine has told the U.S. it needs about 500 of them each day. Well, for what feels like weeks, we've been talking about the hundreds of Ukrainians still trapped inside a steel plant in Mariupol and the false starts on humanitarian evacuation deals. Well, President Zelensky on Sunday said that some people are getting out and at least 100 had been evacuated on Sunday. The civilians had sheltered in tunnels under the plant, along with hundreds of other civilian and Ukrainian fighters still defending the city against the Russians. Zelensky said the freed civilians would be taken to a controlled area as the United Nations and other international groups try to get more people out. Closer to home, Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas issued a stern warning to immigrants who might attempt to enter the U.S. through its southern border. On Sunday, he said, quote, do not come. And he emphasized that if a record-breaking 18,000 migrants are encountered at the border daily, as anticipated by the department, it would put a, quote, strain on the system. That's an understatement. Well, unfortunately, the Manhattan grand jury that was hearing evidence against Donald Trump is expiring. A lot of questions about what went on in that Manhattan DA's office. But meanwhile, prosecutors in Fulton County, Georgia, begin selecting a grand jury who'll consider whether the former president should be charged with criminally disrupting the 2020 election. A key piece of evidence is a phone call that the former guy made on January 2nd, 2021, to Georgia's Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, in which Trump told him, I just want to find 11,780 votes. So this is your regular reminder that just because people want COVID to be over doesn't mean it is. But big gatherings are happening again. For instance, lots of ridiculous outfits will be on display tonight for fashion's biggest event of the year, the Met Gala 2022. You might remember last year brought us AOC's infamous Tax the Rich dress. And that's also when we learned way too much information about Nicki Minaj's cousin's friend's big testicles, right? And of course, on Saturday night, the White House Correspondents Association annual dinner was back after a years-long absence due to both COVID and a president without a sense of humor. Trevor Noah struck just the right chord.
Ron is playing it coy, man. He won't even tell people if he got the booster. Yeah, or as they say in Florida, don't ask, don't tell. Am I right? I see you, Ron. You see, what I like about Ron DeSantis is like if Trump was the original Terminator. DeSantis is like the T-1000. You know, you're smarter than him. You're slicker than him. You can walk down ramps. Yeah. Because you see, no, Trump said he won the election, but everyone was just able to look at the numbers and see that he was wrong. That's why Ron DeSantis is one step ahead. First you ban the math textbooks, then nobody knows how to count the votes. Boom, my man.
And even President Biden was in rare form.
Everyone had to prove they were fully vaccinated and boosted. So if you're at home watching this and you're wondering how to do that, just contact your favorite Fox News reporter. They're all here, vaccinated and boosted. All of them.
And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is 100% listener supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.